Maboff!
This is Scammapalooza. My name is Nicholas J. Johnson. For more information on today's show, check out conman.com.au. Some con artists will take your money, others will steal your identity, but it takes a special brand of scumbag to mess with your health. That is exactly what Andrew Wakefield did in 1998 when he published a fraudulent paper in the Lancet Journal claiming that the MMR vaccine causes autism. This week I am joined by infectious diseases doctor and host of the Quackcast, Mark Crislip, as we reveal what Wakefield had to gain from the hoax and the ramifications of his audacious scam. My name is Nicholas J. Johnson and this is Scammapalooza. Before we get to my chat with Mark, I thought I'd give you a quick update on what has gone down between now and when I spoke to Mark 3 weeks ago. So last week, I was invited to perform at Disrupted, the Festival of Ideas in Western Australia, as a part of the book tour for my new novel, Fast and Loose. The event was run by the State Library of WA and packed with the country's top thinkers and intellectuals. I have no idea why I was invited. I tend to get invited along to these sort of events and find myself sitting on a panel or on a lineup with people far smarter and more intelligent than me. I look at all these, scientists and great thinkers and always kind of think of myself as maybe like the gorilla that they've just taught how to do sign language. Anyway, I was invited along to this event and was asked to sort of close the day with a talk on con artists and scams. And I discovered that one of the other speakers there was popular cartoonist Michael Lunig. For our international listeners, Lunig has spent the past 40 years drawing whimsical cartoons of ducks and curly-headed men despairing over the existential crisis of modern life. He is an Australian icon, he's a national treasure, but in recent years he's also become an outspoken anti-vaccination campaigner. So after my conversation with Mark Crislip about vaccinations and the history of fraud in the anti-vaccination movement, I found myself torn because I had to perform alongside a guy like Lunig. And this is a guy who compares vaccinations to fascism. And I should say, while I was there to talk about con artists and scams, I do not see Michael Lunig as a con artist. In any case, he got up, he gave a presentation in front of the 200-strong crowd, talked a lot about spirituality and the soul and the individual. It was a little vague for my taste, but the audience absolutely loved it, gave him a huge round of applause and all rushed out to buy his books. Neither Lunig nor anyone else brought up vaccination in the presentation or in the panel discussion afterwards or the Q&A session or any of the other presentations. I knew that everyone must have been aware of his position because this is something that's made the papers. He's given interviews defending himself without really explaining himself in that way in which only an artist can. He sort of answers every question with more questions and more raised eyebrows. In any case, no one throughout the entire day said a thing. So finally, it was my turn to get up. I gave my usual talk, did a few card tricks. I hammered a nail into my face and all the sort of stuff that I do at these types of events. And then finally, at the very end, I showed one of Lunig's most recent cartoons, the one of the mother pushing the pram being chased by flying syringes. Lunig is nothing if not subtle. I explained that I didn't think he was a con man, but I did think he was misleading people, using emotion over fact to manipulate his audience, and in doing so was endangering people's lives. I mentioned the young local baby who had recently died of whooping cough. That was just a month or so ago. And I talked about the responsibility of artists to tell the truth. And then I left the stage. Afterwards, I had dozens of people coming up to me and they all said the same thing. They said, "Oh, I'm glad you said something because I was worried that no one would." One woman even mentioned that she was friends with the mother of the young boy who'd recently passed away of this preventable illness, whooping cough. And she said the same thing. "I'm glad you said something. I was worried no one would." And while it was great getting a pat on my head for doing what I thought was the right thing and feeling like my opinions were validated and shared by the room, the whole experience just left me thinking, in a room full of the smartest people in the country, in front of an extraordinarily intelligent crowd, why was it the con man who had to say something? Well, thank you very much for joining me on the podcast today. You are a doctor by trade?
Yeah, my full-time job is an infectious disease doctor in Portland, Oregon. I've been doing it for 25 years now.
And yet your night times are filled with podcasting about what you call scams.
alternative medicines and obscure medical practices and things that you see as not up to medical rigor.
Yeah, that became a hobby about 8 years ago now, I think. I've been podcasting actually for a decade now, so I'm one of the old geezers. But I started the Quackcast about 8 years ago, and I talk about my kind of scams, supplement, complementary, and alternative medicine. So I've been podcasting about scams for about 8 years, and I've been writing for Science-Based Medicine for 6 years now. So it keeps me occupied in my spare time.
And do you see all things which are defined as alternative medicine as being quackery? Because I know there are a lot of people, and they tend to be more consumers than the medical practitioners, who will see the words alternative medicine and say, no, alternative medicine equals non-scientific.
But it varies. I mean, there's a spectrum, and it sometimes it's branding, sometimes it's quackery, sometimes there's things in between. So there are things that are absolutely wackaloon, like Reiki or homeopathy. And there's things that may or may not be true, like botanicals and herbs. Maybe there is something in it, maybe there's not. They just haven't been tested. And then there's things that are called alternative that aren't, like diet and exercise. So there's a spectrum. And the problem is that when people talk about scams, my kind of scams, they never specify. Are they talking about the off-the-wall wackaloon stuff? Are they talking about stuff that maybe has validity? Or are they talking about standard stuff that's rebranded as alternative to get them in the front door? So there's, I'm nuanced. On the other hand, science-based medicine is sort of the, I'm blanking on the phrase, another senior moment.
Fundamentalist medicine.
Fundamentalist, yes, yeah. That would work, perhaps.
I come from a sociology background, and we were always taught about the idea of the role of a sick person and how people like their medicine to come from a specific sort of social group or a social idea. And so for a lot of people, the only way medicine can be legitimate is if it comes from a man in a white coat, whereas for other people, the man in the white coat is the enemy, and the only place that legitimate medicine can come from is from a shaman who has ground some herbs into a paste.
You know, the saying is that if what you call alternative medicine that works is called medicine. It's one of the old phrases from the JAMA a bunch of years ago. But yeah, there's a lot of sociology and psychology in medicine. But at the end of the day, you know, if you have cancer, it doesn't matter what your sociological beliefs are. Either you're taking something that gets rid of the cancer or you're not. And reality doesn't give a rat's ass as to whether or not what the source of your therapy is, be it a shaman or a guy in a white coat. Reality only cares if it works or not. And most of the things I would call alternative medicine just basically don't work.
And that brings us to our subject for today, who is very much a man in a white coat, or at the very least was, Andrew Wakefield, who is responsible for, I would say, probably the greatest medical hoax of the last 25 years. I can't think of any bigger hoaxes than his. Can you think of anything larger?
Not offhand, at least nothing that's had the same adverse impact. There's always things that come and go in popularity, but he's had his effect has certainly been more persisting than prior things like Laetrile, probably because of social media and that sort of ability to keep your message out there. But yeah, he's been pretty remarkable, the adverse effects he's had on people.
And it all comes back to a 1998 paper that he wrote, which forwarded the idea that vaccines, really the MMR vaccine, causes autism.
Yeah. The interesting thing is the paper never really said that. That was never mentioned in the paper. That was the post-paper, the interviews and the spin that came after the paper. The paper was very circumspect. It said that they did not show an association between measles, mumps, rubella, and autism. They didn't say that in the paper, but they implied it. And it was afterwards that the brouhaha came out. The paper itself is actually reasonably bland. Unfortunately, it's bland lies, but they're bland nonetheless.
Because it wasn't he wasn't the only author. I think he had half a dozen or more co-authors who were sort of involved in the paper as well. And yet Wakefield is the one who's sort of held up as the person responsible. And is that largely because of that media outcry that occurred or the media attention?
And as I remember it, I have to go back and reread that particular aspect. But as I remember it, as often happens when people write papers, the lead researcher gets a lot of people to help out with smaller things, but doesn't really tell them the overall picture because people like to get their names on papers. So a lot of people will help out on a paper that really had nothing, they had something to do with it, but not with sort of the meat of the paper. They help with the study or patient acquisition or things like that. But he was evidently the mastermind behind the whole thing.
And we should clear it up. Does the MMR vaccine cause autism?
Absolutely, positively not. There's no association between any vaccine and autism. But he found, kids who got the MMR had a certain kind of lymphoid bowel tissue on their biopsies who had autism. But he never really said that the MMR caused autism. That all got said after the paper was published.
Rather than the science being done in the laboratory, it was done later on in media interviews by him and other people.
Yeah.
Why do you think he really, I mean, obviously we don't know exactly why he did it, but do you have any guess as to why he wanted people to believe this and why he was so keen to sort of get this idea out there?
Well, one, he was given, a buttload of money by lawyers to look for research to prove a link between autism and vaccine, about £500,000, which I think in American money is either $5 or $5 million. I forget what the ratio, conversion is.
It's about double, I think.
£500,000 is a lot of money. And he also had a patent for a single dose measles vaccine. So he was looking to sell a product. So he was looking to, he had a lot of financial reasons to discredit the MMR, which was not known by The Lancet at the time. He had a very compelling financial reason to make the MMR look bad.
And we should say The Lancet was the medical journal that the paper was originally published in. Why do you think they published it? Do you think do you think that they should have had more rigorous editorial standards, or do you think that it wasn't really their responsibility?
It's a little bit of both. I mean, one of the things about preliminary papers, and this is a study of only 12 kids, is that preliminary papers usually don't have to have quite the rigor that a large study does. And they're like any other news organization, they have to fill space. And the general rule is you believe that all the people who are working are basically honest people with integrity. And so if you're neither honest nor have integrity, you'll screw people over every time, because I just always assume everyone I work with is doing the right thing. And same with, so they read it with under the context is, well, I don't know if this is legitimate or not, but it's different and it's interesting and maybe it's real, but it's preliminary. We'll throw it out there. It'll generate more research. It'll get some buzz and some clickbait, but it's pretty standard to have that kind of happen for small early studies. A lot of garbage gets published that may or may not be reproduced later.
Yeah, I'm reminded of the recent study which came out that proved that chocolate helps weight loss. Which of course everyone commented on and everyone shared it and everyone said, look at this study that has proven beyond a shadow of a doubt that that an all chocolate diet is somehow going to be good for you. And then it was revealed to be a hoax just to prove that exact point. So, I mean, he had a fairly small sample for the original study, didn't he? He only had sort of eight or nine children that he was looking at.
Yeah, 12, I believe.
12 children. As you said, it's a preliminary study.
Yeah.
Do you think that this is a common problem, is that we take these sort of small preliminary studies, the media doesn't really look at them, they just simplify it down to a clickbait headline and sort of send it out into the world?
Oh, absolutely. That happens with even big studies, is that nobody actually bothers to read them carefully and ask the question, you know, does this really say what it says? Which often it doesn't. It's quite remarkable if you actually read papers carefully that the spin in the abstract may not necessarily represent what is actually in the meat of the paper. It's sort of weird that way. And it takes a lot of time and tedium to read papers carefully. They're written in the dullest prose possible. So it takes a lot of effort to get through them.
And this is something that, even though this is sort of pre-social media, back in 1998, people very much grabbed a hold of the idea and ran with it. And you have that kind of 4 or 5 year period where he was out and without a lot of people really sort of arguing that he was wrong, pushing this anti-vaccination agenda. And that's when Jenny McCarthy comes on the scene. And so her appearing on Oprah and saying that she felt that this was true, do you think that that played a large role?
I don't know how much she certainly has been out there about the anti-vaccine. How much a role it had, I do not know. That's an interesting question, actually. But certainly it was high, seen by a lot of people. And Oprah here is somewhere between God and football. So if she showed up, American football, if she showed up on Oprah, it would be noted. And she's a very personable. I don't know if you ever heard her interviewed. But she's actually a very engaging woman. She's obviously bright and funny and entertaining and intelligent, and she's fun to listen to. Sometimes the content sucks, but she's quite the engaging person. And if she came out and started talking about this, I can see where people would buy into what she had to say.
Yeah, what's interesting is when you watch the interview that she has with Oprah, she basically brings up the fact that her son has autism, and that was sort of the reason for her divorce. And she was on the show, I think, to promote a book, and she said that vaccines can trigger autism. And when Oprah sort of questioned her a little bit more on it, she basically said not that she had read this study from 1998 and Andrew Wakefield and so on, but that it was sort of a maternal instincts made her feel as if this was true. So it was interesting that rather than appealing to reason and logic, she went for the kind of the more emotional maternal instincts as the way to convince people that perhaps what she was saying had some sort of credence.
Yeah, and that's the best way to do it. I mean, seriously, every day in every way when you have to make a decision, you go with your gut feeling. You want to know, you know, what's the best hamburger to eat, you ask your friends and they like a place and you trust what they say, and there's no objective no objectivity behind the best hamburger or the best beer, and you go with what people say who you trust. It's a very compelling way to get an argument out. And in science-based medicine, we have facts and figures, and it sucks as a way of convincing people. It's, you know, 10,000 studies will never beat my uncle's best friend got acupuncture and got better. That wins every single time. That's just the way people are.
Here in Australia, we have a cartoonist called Michael Lunig, who is sort of beloved by everyone for the last 30 years.
Yeah.
Do you know? Have you heard of him?
Well, I just came across it like a week ago because of his vaccination. Comparing it to fascism, is that it?
Oh, he compares everything. He compares everything to fascism. He has very, very strong opinions, and yet he presents them with these very soft, rounded, friendly, or poetic, and quite beautiful cartoons that are very, very convincing. And he's done quite a few anti-vaccination ones. I'll read you one of his poems. Some mothers do have them. They have maternal instincts. They contradict what science thinks. They stand up to the state. A mother's love may be as great as any new vaccine that man has ever seen. And it's the images of a mother pushing a baby in a cot while needles fly through the air chasing her down the street, and she's trying to do her best to escape. That's something that is going to influence people's behavior far more than any study.
Yeah, I'll tell you, I have an affinity for English and Australian comedy. The funniest thing out there this year was the Caterling show. I don't know if you've seen that.
Yeah, yep.
That thing, I laughed until I cried when I watched that. It's so funny. And I do not get those cartoons. I went through 40 of his cartoons and I thought about each one, this is lame. Why is this guy popular? I don't get it. I thought I understood Australian and English humor, but that guy is not funny.
You know,
he's a cartoonist guy.
He started out, and he was when he first started, he was very edgy and very political, and he's softened over the years. But because he's an Australian icon, and we see those images and his little soft, big-nosed, curly-headed characters, I think we just get sort of wrapped up in what he has to say, and a lot of people believe it. And that's, I guess that's part of the issue, is that even though Wakefield was sort of struck off as a doctor and the study was put down not only as bad science, but as actually as fraudulent science, that the idea that vaccines cause autism had been taken by people like Lunig and Jenny McCarthy, who you said were very convincing and managed to appeal to people's parents, in particular, fears and the love of their child.
Yeah, and every society has their own different vaccine fear. The French, I think, worry about hepatitis B and multiple sclerosis. Currently, there's a brouhaha in Kenya that the polio vaccine sterilizes girls. So each country has their own unique fear of vaccines, and fear of vaccines goes back to the very first one, vaccinating for smallpox. So it's an ongoing problem. The words change, but the tune has stayed the same for 100 years or more.
Going back to Wakefield, what were the events that led him to be struck off? Was it this particular study, or was it just his general? Was there some sort of broader incompetence as a doctor?
Brian Deer, he wrote a nice expose, and I don't actually remember why he got his medical license yanked. Because it's really hard to lose your degree to practice. I mean, lying and being unethical is a pretty good reason, where you get bribed to do a study and you get kids involved in your study unethically, and you don't have them sign, and the parents sign releases and all sorts of sketchy things. But I don't know if that was enough. Or maybe there's that plus the brouhaha.
In spite of all of that, in spite of being sort of struck off and in spite of it being sort of proven beyond a shadow of a doubt that these vaccines don't cause autism, he still seems to have stuck with the opinion that this is a fact and that he was wronged and that and he has not shown any sort of remorse or any sort of interest in perhaps considering that maybe he may have been wrong in any way. Do you think that he's not reached a point where he believes his own story?
I don't know. It's certainly his gig. You know, that's where he makes his money now. He can't make the money as a physician. So speaking to autism groups, I would suspect it's his major source of income. I don't know. It's hard. I always wonder about him, whether or not he's a true scam artist or if he's a true believer. I can't tell.
Yeah,
I really can't.
He reminds me of Charles Ponzi, who's it's a name that comes up often on this podcast. As Ponzi, you know, obviously the first man to run a Ponzi scheme, and he reached a point where his scam was completely falling apart. There was no more new investors. There was no possible way he could continue taking money from the public, and no way he could ever show any sort of return on investment. And yet he stayed around and tried to convince people that no, this is all going to turn around. And he reached a point where he really believed that he was a master businessman. And that was what led to his downfall. He had time to escape, and he decided to stay and face the music because he believed it. And I feel it's almost the same with Wakefield. He's a martyr. You know, he's been struck down and he's been made into a villain, and yet he's still got his followers who will continue to believe him. And I think as long as he's got them, he'll probably continue telling the same story.
I mean, generally speaking, the only person you ever say you're wrong to is your spouse. And so the rest of the world, you take a front of, I make no mistakes. I'm not going to say I'm sorry. The reason I think he believes it is I cannot understand how somebody could be so sociopathic, to be so... I know those people are out there, and I've met them, and I've taken care of them, but I always have trouble believing that somebody can be that much of a sociopath to be that evil willingly. I mean, yeah, you know, let's just say the opposite of good is not evil. The opposite of good is good intentions. I'm sure he doesn't see himself. No one's ever a bad guy in their own narrative. I think probably Hitler, Stalin, and Mao Zedong all thought they were wonderful people.
Hitler says, I'm a vegetarian, you know? Of course, yeah.
Yeah, Stalin didn't shave in the morning, you know, looking in the mirror thinking, God, I'm one of the worst sons of bitches ever. No, he probably looked in the mirror and thought, I'm a good guy. I'm doing what I need to do. He probably says the same thing.
Sure. He's probably saying, well, you know, look, I vaccinate my kids. I'm a good guy.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, nobody's a bad guy in their own story. I bet. I don't know. Yeah. Maybe I'm too naive there.
Yeah.
I just can't imagine anybody to be that manipulative and that sociopathic who isn't running for the presidency of the United States.
I'd like to just go back to Jenny McCarthy quickly.
Sure.
So there's a website which is the anti-vaccine body count, which used to be the Jenny McCarthy body count, which was changed. And it's the number of preventable illnesses, which is around the, let's see, it's around 150,000. And then the number of preventable deaths, which is around 9,000. And that's since she made that statement. And the number of autism diagnoses, which is zero. Do you think that it's fair to sort of place that blame at the feet of people like Jenny McCarthy, or do you think they're victims, you know, people who should know better, like Wakefield?
You know, you should take responsibility for what you say. And if you're, what you say leads to that, I think you get some responsibility for that. Vaccine preventable illnesses kill people. And they really do. In the third world, enormous numbers of people. And getting rid of them and preventing them is one of the great inventions, along with flush toilets, that we've ever had for preventing illness. And yeah, I think you got to own up. If you say don't get vaccines, you don't get vaccinated, you're partly responsible. Someone takes your word and does it.
We have just introduced in Victoria, which is the state that I live in, a law that essentially says that you cannot bring your child to any childcare unless they've been vaccinated. And there's been a little bit of an outcry from people saying that's taking away from our freedom to, you know, how we're going to raise our children. But for the most people, I think people understand that it is, you need to vaccinate your children. And that when people sort of speak out against that, they are endangering not just their own child's lives, but other children's lives as well.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you don't have the right to endanger other people's lives. I suppose you also ban handguns in your schools as well.
We do, yeah. We have very strict gun laws in Australia.
You're lucky.
Very lucky, yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, you know, handguns kill people. You don't want them brought to school either, and other things. They're dangerous, and, you know, measles, those things kill people. And when they hit, man, do they spread fast in non-immune populations. It's very impressive. Measles is one of the most infectious diseases out there, with almost 100% of people exposed getting the illness. And it's a bad disease. And we could eradicate it, too. That's what really fries my bacon. And if we did it right, we could eradicate measles off the face of the planet. We eradicated rinderpest, which is the measles of animals. And it probably jumped from animals into humans. And measles is actually the human version of rinderpest. We got rid of rinderpest. It's gone. We could do the same if it wasn't for people who didn't get vaccinated.
Are there any dangers of vaccines? I mean, are there anything which people should think about in terms of vaccinations? Because there's always the stories that people tell of the things that might happen if you don't vaccinate your children. But is there really anything that people need to be worried about?
Occasionally people do get bad responses to what's in the vaccine. Some vaccines are not as good as others. The old whooping cough vaccine caused a lot of side effects to it. People just like a risk-free environment. And that's what they're looking for, zero risk. And there's nothing in life with zero risk. I was using my favorite, I don't know if you heard it, my favorite car metaphor. Certain number of people die every year from airbags being deployed. Now, nobody dies from vaccines, but I sure as hell rather have an airbag in a car accident than not, just as I'd rather have a vaccine in a world of vaccine illnesses than not.
And I guess that is always the issue. I mean, in Australia, it's not quite the same, but in America, I know the idea of individual freedom is extraordinarily important. And so if you have someone who comes along and says, I've got a reason why you should give up your freedom to make this decision, that you should, everyone should take part in this together. I can see that annoying some people. And so when you have someone like Wakefield who comes and says, no, this is a bad idea, that you can, I can see why people would leap at what he has to say.
Yeah, there used to be back in the 20s and 30s the idea that the, you know, rising tide lifts all boats. In the last 30 years, the United States have really gone to a screw you, I've got mine approach, which I think is sad because it's good to work together to, for everyone's benefit. And, the other thing about people who, don't want to get their kids vaccinated is they don't want to take any responsibility for the consequences of that. And to quote Peter Parker, with great power comes great responsibility. If you're not going to have your kid vaccinated, then you need to be responsible for any of the consequences if your kid passes on the disease. Funeral costs and hospital bills and all that sort of stuff. People want freedom, but with freedom comes responsibility, and the anti-vaccine people don't want the responsibility.
And that seems to be something which you see come back over and over again, is to sort of say, well, I'll just ignore this evidence, or ignore the evidence that is perhaps difficult to look at, and focus on what is going to help me continue the way that I've been living.
No, so we're all excellent motivated reasoners. So we always will argue and look for things that support our pre-existing beliefs.
Although only a few people try and profit off that, you know, the people who are profiting off the anti-vaccination movement, people not just who are trying to use confirmation bias to confirm what they already believe, but people who are trying to take advantage of people's fears and worries to make money. And I mean, that is now what Andrew Wakefield is doing, because he, as you said, he doesn't really have any other income if the anti-vaccination movement disappears.
None. So he has a compelling reason to keep his story going.
Yeah.
I wonder how much he gets paid for a talk.
It's interesting. He got he's done a lot of talk at chiropractic colleges, apparently. So, which is like, that's an interesting.
I didn't know that.
An interesting ally. To wrap up, I like to always do the con man's dictionary, which is where I give you a word or a phrase, and then you have to try and see if you can help me figure out what it means. What is an apple?
There's, the Apple is the best computer you can use.
Oh, that is fantastic product placement, buzz marketing. it's neither in the context of being a computer or a delicious treat. What do you think an apple might be in the world of the con artist?
I don't know. I guess if you're concerned about the gravity of the situation.
Oh, that's good. Oh, I like that. Because the con artists, they love a good pun and a good double entendre.
Yeah,
no, this is... This,
yeah, what about the... I don't know. Something that you have to ripen over time before you can get the score.
Ooh, you're pretty... It is a word that's used to refer to a mark or a sucker. And the idea is you're waiting for them for just the right moment for the apple to be ripe, and then you can pick them.
I would have used pear or tomato, because they tend to, you pick them and then you ripe them for a while, as opposed to ripening on the tree, but
okay. Medical and gardening tip. If you want to listen to your podcast, it is the Quackcast is the name.
Yeah.
But you've also got a website, what you call your media empire. What's the website?
Whenever I ask my son for some pop culture reference for my podcast, he always would say to me, oh, being edgy again, Dad. So just to piss him off, I named my website Edgy Doc. Why is edgydoc.com?
Oh, thank you so much. I really appreciate being on the show.
As always, you can find out more at conman.com.au. This has been Scammapalooza.